Hello and welcome back to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and FBI profiler, and I'm here today with
Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, and Jim is my colleague. He writes, and I cast for killers, victims, and everything in between.
Laura Richards today is on travel, and she'll be joining us again next time.
Today, we wanted to answer the many listener questions and comments that we've gotten on our Facebook pages and in the Real Crime Profile email account. We've been remiss. We have a lot to catch up on. You guys have been such a great audience. I can't believe that our listeners, they're so insightful and so smart and so balanced in their views and accepting of others' views while still making comments that they believe in. I think it's really important.
Yeah. I think what it is, I mean, we're trying to keep a much more highbrow approach than some of the trolls that are out there.
Yeah.
You know, we're not here to attack people. We're telling you what we believe and have learned over the course of our careers, and we want to share that information. People can take it or leave it for what it is, but the fact is that both Laura and I have had long careers in this field, and we've gained some insights that maybe the average person out there, or even the very educated people out there, may not have been exposed to. So we're trying to explain things in a way that everybody will understand things better. And we're totally open to comments, and you know, there have been a bunch of them, so we will try to discuss a few of them today.
So just a few housekeeping things before we dig into the comments. People have asked about posting our recommendations in one place that everybody can find them. I'm trying to figure it out on Facebook page. It's kind of hard to post them where they remain at the top, but I think we're going to be building a website soon, crossing fingers. So the website will have our list of recs and, you know, all different kinds of information for people, resources to go to if you need help, a link to Jim's website, a link to Laura's Paladin website. So that's coming. And our theme music. So many of you have asked about our theme music by
Simba.
Zumba.
Okay, and that's coming shortly. What happened was his hard drive got fried. He had to recreate the song from scratch. In the process, he wanted to sort of update it and expand on it a little bit so that anybody who wanted to purchase it could get a longer and more updated version.
Can I just say that when I told Simba, who is the sweetest person in the world, I said, you know, Simba, people really want to, you know, they want to buy your song. And he was just like, really? That's incredible. No, I don't believe it. I cannot be so. He could not
He doesn't
fathom.
Exactly sound like that, Lisa. But anyway, he does have a lot of talent, and he's not some kind of egomaniac. So he's really happy that people are interested in the song, and he's got a lot of other ones, so
good.
I'm hoping that
we'll
he
put together
to post
yeah,
all of them.
Absolutely. And one last thing. So Jim's dad, Pete Clementi, did record a podcast with our producer, Paul Francis Sullivan, for his own podcast, Sully Baseball Daily. So that'll be coming down the pike soon. And Paul just loved talking to your dad.
My dad was a baseball player, a pitcher, who played semi-pro ball and then was drafted into the Pirates AAA League way back when in the 50s. So he had some pretty interesting insights to baseball from a half century ago. Pretty amazing.
Okay. So now we're going to turn to listener questions and comments. And on a more serious note, I cannot believe how many emails we've gotten from people currently in abusive relationships reaching out to us for help. I mean, it's been heartbreaking, it's been humbling and shocking that I'm grateful they're reaching out, but they're reaching out to, you know, a fledgling podcast. And who should they be reaching out to, Jim?
Well, they are reaching out to a world-renowned expert in the field, though. It's not just
I know that. But
and that's
what I mean?
Why they're reaching
yeah,
out.
Yeah, no, I know.
Laura has built her career on actually doing this work. I've had certainly peripheral experience with it, but Laura's experience is much greater than mine in this area. And that's why at the end of the podcast, we have Laura reading out a list of resources for people to go to and numbers to call. Now, of course, those don't cover every place in the world, but typically, if you're in a place other than the UK and the United States of America, you should be able to Google resources for domestic violence. And most countries are now actually putting in place programs to help people who are the victims of domestic violence. And when Laura returns, I'm sure she will be able to give us much greater insights into these areas. Mm-hmm. However, for now, we didn't want to just let these messages go sitting idle. Mm-hmm. The fact is, if you are in a situation where you're being abused within your domestic living situation, whether you're male or female, mm-hmm. There are resources available, and hopefully soon we'll have a Paladin USA, which will be a stalking and domestic violence prevention advocacy service for victims. This is something that Laura has been working tirelessly for, and she will be even more dedicated to that cause when she returns.
And one thing that we have done to the people who have written in is we've forwarded them the DASH risk assessment for them to, you know, look through, take the assessment, and then take that to law enforcement. So you start documentation, you know, about what's going on. I mean, you know, Jim, a mother wrote to me that she's been trying to leave. She's been trying to, under the radar, take classes and try to find a job in which to leave because she's kind of waiting for all the ducks to be in a row for her to leave. And what would you say? I mean, does...
It's, you know, this is exactly the scenario that is portrayed in the movie Sleeping with the Enemy. And it's something that I do not feel qualified to make an actual assessment on, certainly via an email or via a podcast. I mean, each case is individual, and there are risks involved that I would like to have professionals evaluate before somebody makes some kind of move. But clearly, reaching out in a way that won't notify the person who's the offender in this case or in each case is probably the best thing to do. Find the local helplines or local services that help victims. If you're in a small town that doesn't have anything like that, there may be church groups, there may be community centers, or you may have to get in touch with somebody in the nearest city,
right?
Because most cities in the U.S. would have such a program.
One more thing on this. There was a listener who says that our podcast has renewed her energy to leave because she did reach out. She did take the DASH risk assessment a while ago, and she took it to a women's shelter. But because her husband didn't have a gun, he was abusing her, choking her. But because he didn't have a gun, they deemed that she wasn't in a life or death situation, and they sent her away. And Laura's response was, even some of these shelters don't necessarily have all the training, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't, if you have a gut instinct to leave, try to get more help. So when Laura comes back, I'm sure she can go in much more detail, but I just wanted to know that we hear you, and we want to help in whatever way we can. And if you're hearing this right now and you identify with what we're saying, you know, please reach out to us, and Laura will try to help.
Definitely.
So if you've been following our tracking of the O.J. Simpson television show on FX, you know that we've talked quite a lot about the defense and their tricks, and we talked quite a lot about the jury and their verdict. A lot of you, I'm going to bundle up a bunch of questions and comments, you know, have really, I mean, they understand that this particular defense team was up to dirty tricks, but they also point out that the prosecutors are not immune to misconduct themselves. So do you have anything to say about that, Jim?
Well, sure. I mean, here's the thing. People in these jobs are individuals, and they have different codes of ethics, and there are very clear rules and for prosecutors, and it is much more scrutinized. Prosecutorial behavior is much more scrutinized because everything that's done is done, supposedly, is done on the record. Most of what the defense does can be hidden from view of the public, from the prosecutor, etc. The defense does not have any burden in the course of a criminal trial. Therefore, They can remain completely silent. They could just cross-examine people. And they can basically defend a case by innuendo. In other words, everything the prosecutor puts into trial is meant towards to be evidence to prove the guilt of the person they're trying. And they have to prove it by beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense, though, can make suggestions, innuendos, bold-faced lies if they want, and they don't have to prove a thing. They just have to mention it. And in some cases, like in the case of O.J. Simpson, they're able to, on top of the fact that of his celebrity, of the racial tensions that they were able to stir up during the course of the trial, and the fact that he was simply a wealthy guy who could afford multiple very expensive attorneys, mm-hmm. all that together gave him the edge in this trial. Prosecutorial misconduct is something that's very serious. It's something that has incredibly devastating consequences when it happens, because obviously if somebody is tried because they've committed a crime and they are convicted, but during the course of that trial there was prosecutorial misconduct, the case could be thrown out. It could be thrown out without prejudice to refile, or it could be thrown out with prejudice, because if somebody's already been tried and they got convicted as a result of prosecutorial misconduct, you may not be able to try them again. And that would be, of course, a travesty. In addition, if they committed misconduct, you could have a mistrial and then start the thing from scratch. If they if it was discovered years later, evidence and witnesses might not be available. So there's so many problems with doing that, which is why I think most prosecutors try to not step over any lines, because certainly the effects of it can be devastating to what their profession is.
Would you say that in the Brendan Dassey trial that the prosecution stepped over any lines that you can think of? I mean,
Absolutely.
we know that the law enforcement, the coerced confession, but...
Well, wait, but we don't know that's misconduct. It can be complete incompetence. Mm. The detectives actually suggesting the answers out of frustration. It could have been, I don't know how many times these guys have actually done interrogations of somebody with limited intelligence of that age group. I have no idea how many homicides they've investigated in their lives, in their careers. I don't know what training they've had. It could have been deliberate. It very well could have been. But it could also have been out of ignorance. They just did not know that by saying something, by letting a kid with a 70 IQ guess at answers and saying no, 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 yeah, that's it, mm-hmm. you know, that they were actually cementing in his brain a way to get out of this room, to get done with this, mm-hmm. to be helpful, and actually got a completely false confession from him. Although I don't know if it's completely false, because he may very well have been involved in the cleanup. There seems to have been evidence of other things like that. But now let's go to the prosecutor in the Dassey and Avery trials. Here's the thing. When that prosecutor held a press conference based solely on the information from Brendan Dassey's, quote, confession, and told the world the details of how he now believed the murder was committed, I believe he stepped way over the line. The entire world had access to that information at that point. There is no way now to actually protect any information so that when they do an interrogation, if somebody does confess to the crime, that they can actually drill down and ask questions about details, because they gave away all the details.
Yeah.
And these details were so flimsy, so ridiculous, so just absurdly crazy, that he actually said, if anybody is under the age of 15, don't listen to this. Like, why the hell are you talking about this? Do you realize there's a victim's family out there? Do you realize that this victim had a right to privacy about, even if this was true, mm-hmm. about what had happened to her? Mm-hmm. What is wrong with you that you're going to go and give a press conference to lay out what your case is at trial. And guess what? When you came to trial, you didn't even use that information against Avery. I mean, it's clear. It's clear that that was absurd. Mm-hmm. It's clear that he was so full of himself and his other behavior, as it leaked out, right, with respect to sexting victims of domestic violence. I mean, this guy's ego was through the roof.
Yeah.
It led him to do some asinine things, and I mean that. And I believe that that did amount to prosecutorial misconduct.
Okay.
I believe that that, in and of itself, not only tainted the jury pool, but it also tainted any potential witnesses out there that may have actually witnessed something, and now they're adding information based on what he said. I think there was a perfect example in the trial with the 15 or 16-year-old mm-hmm. cousin.
Mm-hmm.
of Brendan Dassey, who told her school officials that, you know, that Brendan had been crying and Brendan had confessed to her. But then on the stand, she broke down, and I think it was, if you listen to that episode of our podcast, you'll see, I think behaviorally, there's something you cannot fake when sort of the blood sort of was rising in her face as the questions were coming out, as the realization, she started just breaking down. And I mean, it was not an act. I mean, it was very, very clearly her behavior, her feeling like, oh my God, I got into something that I should never have gotten into. I lied. And now she's sitting there telling the truth. He never said any of that to me. I just was confused. You told mm-hmm. me, basically the prosecutor told her that he was guilty and therefore she wanted to be part of it.
Right.
Just a shame.
That's very clear. Do you think of any other prosecutors that you've, like, in your experience that have done things out of line, or I don't know if...
Well, I know, I can tell you back, you know, when I was a prosecutor myself, there was a kind of a loud, obnoxious private attorney who said that I committed prosecutorial misconduct, that I had, you know, basically swayed this witness to my theory of prosecuting the case. And the judge basically bought it and dismissed the case. I approached the judge about that afterwards, and I said, what is the basis of that decision? I understand he made allegations, but what is the basis of it? Well, did you see how he testified? He was like 8 years old, and he testified like he's like scripted. And I said, that's because 6 times on the day of trial, you granted that defense attorney an adjournment. Mm-hmm. So 6 times the day before trial, I had to prep him as a witness for trial. He was going to be on the stand for a few days. I couldn't just not prep him. Mm-hmm. So every time, he got better and better and better at it. Mm-hmm. More comfortable with having to tell his story, more comfortable with being in a courtroom. Mm-hmm. And he was very good. He's a very bright, incredibly articulate kid. And because of that, I said, Judge, did you look at the complaint that he filed before he even met me? Mm-hmm. You tell me one thing that he testified to in trial that was not in that complaint. It's all in there. Mm-hmm. It's before he met me. How could I possibly have influenced his testimony? She said, well, I did fail to consider that, but it's too late now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how irresponsible that judge was. And sometimes defense attorneys only have to make a lot of noise and yell and scream and wave their hands, and judges cow down to it. It is a practice of some judges to sort of bend over backwards for the defense, because really, the defendant has the most to lose here, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the defendant appeals after a conviction, and some court of appeals finds that the judge wasn't doing everything they could for the defense, they could get overturned. Mm-hmm. Judges don't want to get overturned.
Right.
Judges want to sit in that job for the rest of their lives and have all this great, you know, history behind them, all the cases that they tried, that they listened to or heard, and they don't want ones that were overturned. They don't want opinions that get overturned. So, you know, it's a way to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it's not justice.
So you've never been a defense attorney. You've never, no. That's like not part of your career or anything like that.
No,
you don't,
but
you don't,
I have yeah. since I became an expert witness, I've testified for prosecution and for defense.
For both.
Even when I was an FBI agent, I was an expert witness, and I was actually called in one case that I testified in the case in chief for by the prosecution. The defense called me in the sentencing because they said, we could never buy an opinion as strong as yours. Mm. And we know, based on your testimony at trial, that you're not going to exaggerate, that you're actually going to tell the truth. And my defendant said, you know him better than he knows himself.
Wow.
So they called me because I wasn't like just biased and just prosecution oriented. So anyway, I have testified on both sides of the fence. There are certainly people who get arrested who are not guilty. There are certainly people who get arrested and are guilty but don't get convicted. I mean, there's two sides to every coin, but it's a huge breakdown in the system when somebody gets arrested and gets convicted and they actually had nothing to do with the crime. Those cases happen. Bob Ruff and his podcast, Truth and Justice, is tracking down a few of those. Some of them, you know, I mean, he's keeping an open mind in all his cases. Some of them look pretty bad. And if you're interested in listening to that, Truth and Justice podcast is amazing. Bob.
He's amazing, but I wouldn't say he's keeping an open mind. I mean, he's much an advocate. He's much a, he's going after people, you know, and I appreciate that.
But I talked to him offline about the cases, and he is keeping an open mind. I think he's finding some damning evidence that indicates that there is corruption and maybe a sort of a high degree of desire to get a conviction at all costs. Mm. So, but I think some of the things that he interprets, he may go a little too far on, but we've had discussions about those things. Because, you know, I mean, Bob, you know, he's a great guy, and he's an incredibly motivated investigator. But this is his first foray into homicide investigations and how long-term criminal investigations work and prosecutions. But he's very bright, and he's doing an amazing job.
I agree. Okay, so I wanted to get into some specific listener questions. These are ones that were posted on our Facebook page, so I don't feel the need to not say their name. So Stacey Seward says, love your podcast. Anxious for the next one to show up. Question, if the OJ trial happened today, do you think a different verdict would come out? Just curious with your thoughts about today's social media and new technology with crime scene evidence handling.
Yeah, I think, first of all, if it happened today, I think because of the OJ case, I think that was a watershed moment in crime scene investigation history. Basically, since that time, law enforcement departments across the country and national, federal agencies all have stepped up their crime scene investigation techniques, the training. There's actually, really due to the show, CSI, a tremendous interest on the part of the public and schools and universities in training people in those areas. So forensic science has taken leaps and bounds. If it happened today, first of all of the investigators would have had phones with cameras, digital cameras. They would have all been taking pictures all over the place. They would have been wearing booties on the scene. They wouldn't have been stepping and tramping blood all over the place. There would have been so much better awareness today. But even without that, based on the evidence that we had then, and I think with the ability for people to actually get a balanced view instead of just a one-sided view of what's being presented, I think that people would have understood. I think there would have been much more in terms of victim advocacy out there instead of just a one-sided view from just the defense in terms of any public statements. I think that the district attorney's office would have been much more savvy in terms of calling a witness like Mark Furman. I think the district attorney's office would have also been more savvy about doing a public promotional work around the trial, and I think that a judge would have prevented the defense from engaging in grandstanding and political and basically racially motivated rallies and so forth, I think they would have put a gag order on those attorneys and prevented anything from getting out. I would think that, on the other hand, the thing that they wouldn't, the court would not be able to prevent, would be the kind of trashy novel crap that came out, the attacks on Marsha Clark, and the leaking of photos, personal photos of hers. I think that stuff probably would have been, that would have been the new battleground, I would imagine, instead of sort of, quote, the legitimate press. I think there would have been a lot of social networking games being played, and probably what the defense would have done if they were operating under a gag order would, they probably would have used other people and other accounts in order to get that information out, because basically at the time, I mean, I was, you know, obviously in law enforcement and working with Dr. Henry Lee at the time. At the time, there was an overwhelming amount of actual physical and forensic evidence against O.J. Simpson.
More than we heard about.
Oh, yeah. But, it didn't all come out in trial. That's what I'm saying. You know, the woman who saw him, he almost crashed into her in an intersection, and he screamed at her, and she recognized him. And but she sold her story to a tabloid, so Marshall Clark didn't put her on the stand. Bad move, Marsha. Bad move. You know, trying to protect your case by taking out the most important, the only eyewitness that puts him on the road at that time, in that truck, which ended up having blood from the victim in it. So, you know, there are issues with that would cut both ways, but I think there would have been a much greater chance of conviction if the prosecution was not hampered by the manipulations that the defense attorneys were able to do in the public.
Something you said about the CSI, just maybe remember, is there like a sort of a backlash to the public's awareness of CSI and that they kind of expect a lot of evidence to come to a conclusion that may, you know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah, I mean, it's called the CSI effect. And the CSI effect is that with the show CSI and the popularity of it and all the different permutations of it, that there has been an expectation built on the part of the jury that every single crime has like a slow motion digital video of the actual crime occurring, all the forensic evidence, beautiful technicians and detectives coming in and telling their stories in compelling ways.
Because they're cast exceptionally well,
Jim. Sure they are. So, yeah, so juries now expect that all the cops, all the forensic scientists, everybody speaks articulately, every scientist can explain things in incredibly, you know, minute detail, yet in a way that the jury understands perfectly, and they all have visual, digital, laser, you know, demonstrations of everything that goes on in this trial. And all, by the way, and there's every single lab that ever exists that does crime work, forensic crime work, has like blue neon lighting, you know, in the background, and everybody wears, you know, Gucci and Ferragamo and.
Hey, don't let BJ hear you complaining about wardrobe.
Okay. All I'm saying is it's a little ridiculous, and that has really raised expectations. So it actually is a negative thing, because what has happened is prosecutions have failed because juries saw real cops, real experts, real evidence, and they said, well, this isn't what I expected from CSI, and they literally dismiss cases, which is, again, not justice. It's not how things should be, which is another reason why I still say that our jury system is just...
Okay, we're going to get into that.
Good.
You made me think of something. When I was living in New York, and I was called so many times to be a juror, and I wanted to be on a jury so bad, because as an actor, I wanted to see what it, you know, I had the Law and Order dunk dunk in my head, and and the courthouses in New York are beautiful, you know, they're
my grandfather built the Manhattan County Courthouse.
Did he really?
Yeah.
We gotta talk about that because my grandfather built a whole bunch of buildings in New York too. Anyway, Italian say.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I wanted to be on a jury so badly, and every time you know they call me Ms. M. Betty, and they say, "What do you do?" and I say, "I'm an actor," they're like, "Next." You know, they would never let me testify. I don't know why. I was discriminated against. I mean, serve on a jury. Anyway. Yeah. So, we're going to get to...
Yeah, they would never let me serve on a jury.
I was going to ask you that. Have you ever been on a jury?
I would love to.
But they would never let
you. Yes, I'm a lawyer. Yes, I'm a former prosecutor. Yes, I'm an FBI agent.
But see, I think this has actually hurt you. Because you have not been on a jury. And this is one thing I have over you, is I have been on a jury.
You just told me they never picked you.
No, but in L.A., they had no problem with me being an actor.
Oh, because they couldn't eliminate all those people.
Well, actually, by then, I wasn't an actor. But anyway, but see, you have not been on a jury.
Yeah, so...
So, anyway, we'll talk about that. Sidebar. Okay,
all right.
Let me go on to the next question. We're kind of getting back to the evidence at the O.J. crime. This question is by Ben Zelovansky. Now, full disclosure, Ben is actually a friend of mine who was in the O.J. FX series. He was in very first episode. He plays the dog walker who finds... Shout out to Ben.
The plaintiff whale of the... what kind of dog? Akita.
Yeah. I remember anyway, Ben, that. He's a friend, and he's also a huge fan of the podcast. So, yay, Ben. Here's his question. Hey, guys, love the show. Here's a question about OJ I've had for a long time. I realize he's not exactly a criminal mastermind, but how does a person do something as brainless as take off one of the gloves at a crime scene and keep the other glove on as he gets home, or dispose of some evidence while leaving a pair of blood-soaked socks in his bedroom, even without knowing about DNA or that blood might be identified? Why not throw the socks in a duffel bag that was going to disappear? Carelessness? Ego? It boggles my mind.
Okay, well, let's start with the gloves. I don't believe that he took them off at one place or the other. I think that he probably took them off at the original crime scene, stuffed them in a pocket or something like that. They may have been so wet with blood that he didn't want to carry it around or get blood on things. The whole point was that we believe that he wore a wetsuit, which would have gone to his wrists, so he needed gloves to cover his hands, and it would have gone down to his ankles, so he needed socks and shoes. And I think if you put that together, that fact together with Cato Kalin's statement that when he was helping OJ get into the limo, that he went to grab a duffel bag and OJ said, "Don't you touch that." And OJ grabbed it. I think that's probably where the wetsuit was, and the shoes. The socks were dark. Blood is dark. Mm. And
so he didn't see it.
I believe he didn't see it. And didn't think about it. The fact is that he is not a criminal mastermind. There's a few things that we look at: criminal sophistication, forensic sophistication, and intelligence. OJ is intelligent, but he has no history of committing crimes where he learned all these details. He did learn some stuff on how to do things from a Navy SEAL who was coaching him for Frogman. He was told how to kill somebody in almost exactly the manner that was used in this case, but he just didn't have the forensic sophistication to know exactly what to do from that point. He also had a very tight timeline. If he did this the way we believe he did this, he left that crime scene in a hurry, had to drive back, almost got in an accident, had to park the Bronco very haphazardly at the curb, jump over the wall, get into his house, take a shower, stuff the bloody clothing in a duffel bag, and then get outside and make it look like he had just woken up from a nap and taken a shower and came out to get on, and then get on a flight to Chicago, where the cops would call him and he would say, "Oh God," instead of, "What happened to her? How did she die? How are my kids?"
Right.
You know, none of those questions, not a single one. And anybody who was in that situation, who didn't know the facts of what happened, would have asked something like, "Oh my God, did somebody break in the house? Where did it happen? You know, are the kids safe? The kids were with her." Mm-hmm. You know, none of that.
Yeah.
Not a thing. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. So that's, I think, that did I cover the second part too? I'm sorry.
I forget. Yeah, you did. The socks, yeah.
Okay.
One thing that you said that I bump on a little bit, it's kind of a small thing, but the whole Frogman thing, I mean, I don't think he needs to get any advice on how to kill Nicole. I mean, he could just kill her. I mean, he's so. I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, why?
No, I don't. Because
you don't?
When you have somebody. No, because when you have somebody.
He's almost killed her a bunch of times.
Okay, but he didn't. No, he never took a knife to her.
No,
before.
No, no. But I mean, as far as with his bare hands, if he's strong enough.
No, but he didn't do that.
Yeah.
So how would he get to the point where he? If you know his behavior with her, why does it change? And what happened? There's an intervening cause, and that is that he was. Preparing for this movie, he specifically asked this guy, how would I kill somebody without getting any marks on me and without leaving any trace evidence on me? And the guy said, a wetsuit. And he said, but won't I still get bruises, or what if they clawed at me or bit me? Maybe she's done that before. And he said, if you wear a 7mm wetsuit, you won't get bruised through that. You take it off and all the forensic evidence goes with you. It's not perfect way to do it. If you're going in the water after that and swimming 10 miles, yeah, it's probably true. But it's not a perfect way. The guy didn't teach him how to do a perfect crime. There was plenty of evidence left there, brought with him, transfer evidence with him back to his house and into the Bronco. So it wasn't the perfect crime. But, I mean, how did OJ gain that information? This is how you typically gain criminal sophistication, by learning it from somebody who's done it before, let's say going to prison and talking to people, or by experience. You try it over and over, you try new things, you read about it, you talk to people who know how to do it, who are trained in doing it, and I believe that could have happened. May not have been, but it's just it's a very good correlation, I think, that you can draw between him asking those questions and then seeing the evidence of those things in this crime scene.
Fair enough. All right, we're going to move on to the subject of hearsay. Mm-hmm. Is that okay? Okay. So Emmy Adams Cairns asks, she loves the podcast, I have to say that. I had a question wondering if you'd help me with, you mentioned the term hearsay quite a lot in reference to Nicole's diaries, and I know what that means in the normal course of events, but would you mind explaining what it means in a legal sense? What makes these letters fall under this category, and is everything deemed to be hearsay automatically disbarred from the trial?
Good question. So let's take them one at a time. So hearsay is statements that are made out of court, outside of court, and because they are made outside of court, they are deemed to be less reliable than statements made by witnesses in court. They are deemed to be hearsay. Now, there's a whole bunch of exceptions to the hearsay rule. That is, hearsay evidence can still come in if, for example, it is the contents of a business document created in the normal course of business, like a police report, for example. If it's sworn testimony, if it is, it can be. One thing that a lot of attorneys will do to get around the hearsay rule, to try to get information into a to the hearing of a jury or a judge, even though they are trying to say that what it's the statement is true, they say it's being offered for the state of mind of the person who said it or the state of mind of the person who heard it, and it's not being offered for the truth of the matter stated within it.
So not the contents.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, the content is important, but what they're saying is, like, in other words, if I tell you I'm going to kill Paul, okay, that would be a hearsay statement. Now, if Paul ends up dead and you get on the stand, you can testify that I made a statement to you, and then they're going to ask you, well, what was that statement? And objection, hearsay. And the attorney that's presenting you as a witness could say, I'm not offering it as the truth of what he stated, but just to your state of mind to explain your actions after that. And the judge may say, okay, I'll allow it for that. Well, then you say, yeah, he told me I'm going to kill Paul. And then the next question is, what did you do after that? I went, I told Paul, I called the police, you know, I did all these things. And that actually tends to corroborate it. So you get in the evidence anyway, which, you know, is actually hearsay and you shouldn't be able to say it, but it's one of the exceptions to the rule.
Okay.
Now, those rules have been expanded by some judges and they've been restricted by other judges. They've been going back and forth for as long as hearsay exceptions have been in existence. And so sometimes it's really a judgment call on the part of the judge himself as to whether or not it will come in. But there are a lot of ways to get it in, and you know, it's just not consistent.
Okay, so now we have a question from Sakura, who is a frequent poster on our Facebook page and just seems like a lovely person. It's a general question about behavioral analysis. She's wondering how you can tell, how it is it possible that somebody who's so mentally unwell and disturbed that they are a serial killer or a murderer, but they don't appear dysfunctional at all, not to their families, not to anybody they work with, and how do they maintain that? And then following up on that, how can you tell the difference between, you know, somebody, can you, are there things that are red flags or...
First of all, I have to tell you that human behavior is incredibly complicated. There are billions of different permutations on every theme when it comes to human behavior. So you have to understand that it's impossible to pigeonhole serial killers, first of all. I belong to a few listservs where we discuss these topics all the time, and they're, even among the experts in the fields, they can't come to an all-inclusive definition of serial killers. Serial killers is a term that has only been in effect in the last 30 years, I would imagine. Before that, they were just seen as people who committed multiple murders, and it's sort of an artificial category that has become very popular in the culture since Silence of the Lambs, basically. Mm-hmm. But even so, there are certain characteristics that some of them do have. If you're talking about psychopathic serial killers, these are people who literally don't have any human empathy. But the smart ones can notice interactions between human beings, and they can mimic that. Mm. So, for example, they can see what it looks like when people are in love. They can see what it looks like when they care for other people, but they don't feel these human emotions. Because of that, they treat people as if they were objects, and they do things that are generally considered very cold and calculating and manipulative. And so they don't feel bad about doing anything to people any more than you might feel of crumpling up a piece of paper and throwing it in the garbage. To them, that's what human beings are. If I can use it, great. If I don't need it, throw it away. If it's fun to do things to that person because you're a sexual sadist or you know, have another one of those paraphilias, that you just do it because you want to, you feel entitled to. So that covers psychopathic serial killers, but there are serial killers along a very broad spectrum, and they have very different motivations. But how do you tell if you're in a relationship or you know somebody who's a psychopath? Well, usually they're charismatic. Usually they will talk their way into and out of any kind of situation. You have to be very vigilant about their actual behavior, though. I mean, are they actually consistent? Are they hiding things? Do they have separate lives? Do they have locked containers that you can't get into? Do they not allow you into their phones and so forth? I mean, you know, if somebody is an open book, they're an open book. But if they're keeping part of their lives private, if they're always traveling, if they're always away, if they always have an excuse, if they always have things going on that you're not part of, I would be very suspicious. And, you know, next time they're going on a business trip, just go into the closet, pull out your bag, and say, oh, I packed too, I'm coming. And see how that goes.
Yeah.
Next time they say, oh, they have an important call for work, say, great, let me see your phone. Introduce me to the person. Mm. You know, do those things. Be unexpected yourself. And push those buttons and see what the hell happens. Great book called The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker, and also Protecting the Gift, which is a sequel about protecting your kids, has to do with listening to your instincts. Our human brains have incredibly sophisticated protection powers, and they don't actually tell you words, but they make the hair stand up on the back of your neck. They make your skin crawl. They make your stomach uneasy. And that is their way of telling you there's a problem. and listen to that. Mm-hmm. And these books will go into basically how you do that. I think there's a tremendous amount of benefit to actually being aware of your own, what your senses are telling you. Your brain is working, your subconscious brain is working 10 billion times faster than your conscious brain. And it's able to crunch data from all your senses all at the same time, and you should really listen to what it's telling you.
Yeah, I was on our show, you didn't tell me this, but another producer on our show says, you know, if you have a bad feeling, if you have a gut feeling, if you're on a hike and you pass somebody and you feel, for whatever reason, unsafe, go back. Or if you're parked next to somebody and you feel, go with that gut feeling. Yeah. But on our show, because I read so many, the scripts are very violent, that I think I'm probably over, I won't park next to a white van. Just matter. I'm very, and also growing up, living in New York for so long, you kind of walk with a certain way of looking at people. I look them in the eye and I look at their hands because they're carrying something. You know what I mean?
It's absolutely true. And, I remember when I was in Hawaii flying back from Manila with prosecutor, firing back from a week-long conference we did on sex trafficking and child sexual victimization. And we had sort of like a 9-hour layover or something, and a storm was coming in to Hawaii. So I said, let's go drive to the North Shore because I know the waves would be coming in big there. And when we got there, they were coming in sets of 6 waves and they were 30 feet high, and it was just an amazing sight. But as I parked the car and went over to the beach, I said, something just doesn't feel right. I went back to move the car right along the beach because there was a parking space there. But as I got into the car and pulled over, a utility truck pulled into that spot. So I had to park behind some trees. And I just didn't feel right about it. I just wanted to get back to the beach, and I did. And then maybe 15, 20 minutes later, I said, you know what? I got to move that car again. I went back to the car. It had been broken into. All of our stuff was stolen.
Oh, shoot.
My FBI credentials were stolen.
God.
It was terrible. I had, I think, $1.67 in my pocket. I had nothing else. We had our tickets. We had our luggage back at the hotel, mm-hmm. So that wasn't going to be a problem. But that's it. And I should have listened much more strongly to my instincts. But many people have gotten out of really bad situations because they did listen to their instincts. It's really an amazing tool that our brain gives us, but we've been socialized away from listening to.
Yeah.
So I would say, listen.
Yeah. And further to, how can somebody hide in plain sight, and be charming and all that? I mean, I know sexual predators do that all the time. These clinical narcissists who, they want to blend in. They want to be close to people. That's why they become coaches and people who are close to their prey. And so they need to be able to fit in and
they develop skills to do it. Mm-hmm. I mean, and some of them are, like I said, are very charismatic. People want to be around them.
Mm-hmm.
They're drawn to their energy. And some of that energy is based on the fact that they are thrill seekers, mm-hmm. that they are, they constantly need stimulation. The bright ones will constantly seek out not only praise and adulation, but also they can be thrill seekers and risk takers. And those kinds of people have amazing stories, and they have great, exploits to tell about, and they draw people into them. Like I said, most of the time, if you drill down, it's a facade, and they can't keep it up. And if you actually ask the hard questions, the ones that you don't want to ask because you don't want to get them pissed off, because you don't want to get them, to think that you're questioning them, make them think you're questioning them. Make them understand that you are not going to just be taking their word for anything. And, because anybody can tell a story. Mm-hmm. The smart ones can tell really complicated stories and remember all the details.
Mm-hmm.
But even those guys can be tripped up if you actually ask enough of those deep drill down questions. It's sort of the chop an onion in half and you see the rings of the mm-hmm. onion. you know, most of these guys will make up stories that will go three or four layers deep. But if you drill down and keep asking more specific, detailed questions and take notes and remember the answers and follow through with them and see if there's corroboration and make sure that, you know, the next time you don't let the guy just walk away and tell you a story, I think that way you'll be able to suss out the facts that this person is or isn't real.
Well, you know what? I think we have an entire podcast on just these questions. So, you know what? We have so many more questions to get to. I haven't even scratched the surface. And so I think we can probably do a second podcast on listener questions. We haven't even gotten to the posts about the jury. There's a lot to go over. So maybe we'll sign off here.
See you soon. Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions. Real Crime Profile is distributed by Wondery.